This is the Dr. Denise Show. I'm Dr. Denise McDermott, an adult and child psychiatrist specializing in an integrative approach to mental health. I believe in prescribing the least amount of medication coupled with a comprehensive treatment plan. My goal is to empower you to thrive, and I take a multidimensional approach to wellness, not illness. You are not your symptoms. Call upon your best and highest self to embrace your mental health. On this program, you will meet many doctors, experts, and pioneers who have helped pave the way to shift the paradigm of getting rid of the stigma of mental illness in our society. This show was created for those of you who would like new ways of thinking and understanding about mental health and helping your loved ones to thrive and cope in empowered ways. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Daniel Mueller. He is an associate professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto and is the head of the Pharmacogenetics Research Clinic at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. He's also a clinical psychiatrist at the Mood and Anxiety Program. He has published more than 160 articles, with the focus of his research being on an investigation of the genetic factors that predict response to antidepressant and antipsychotic medications. He has been awarded the Clerman Prize for Exceptional Research in Clinical Brain and Behavior Science by the U.S.-based Brain and Behavior Research Foundation in 2013. He was also awarded the Innovation in Psychopharmacology Award by the Canadian College of Neuropsychopharmacology in 2016. He is a true pioneer in setting expert guidelines for patients and doctors in the area of pharmacogenetics, the branch of pharmacology concerned with the effect of genetic factors on reactions to drugs. It is an honor to have Dr. Mueller on our show today. It is an honor to have Dr. Mueller on my show today. So good morning, Dr. Mueller. It's an honor to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So how's everything going in Canada this morning?
Well, I can only speak for Toronto, but so far everything looks okay. We have a mild winter. We only have about 2 degrees right now. We only have means like it's good for us, 2 degrees Celsius. Which means it could be much colder at this time of the year. So I think that elevates the mood a little bit here in Toronto.
Oh, good.
That people don't have to struggle too much with shoveling snow and getting to work, you know, in snow slush and these kind of things. As beautiful as the snow is, but, you know, you don't want to have it when you need to go to work in the morning when you commute, right?
Right.
It's nicer to have it in the, you know, have it in the in the lands where the cottages are and where, you know, you want to do some cross country skiing and other things. But anyway,
very good.
Things are okay here, and I can't complain, I guess.
Good. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And You know, as doctors, it's important that we properly assess our patients and we take a holistic approach that includes nutrition, good exercise, right, sleep, and that we utilize medication only when absolutely necessary. But when we do use medicines, it's so crucial to find the right medicine with the least amount of side effects. And it's important that, you know, we all realize that each of us metabolizes medication in our own unique way. So I'm just so excited to have you on the show, Dr. Mueller, as you are the head of one of the first pharmacogenetics research clinics worldwide that's leading the way for implementation models for pharmacogenetics. Can you explain for our listeners exactly what pharmacogenetics is?
Yes, absolutely. It's my pleasure to do so. So basically, you mentioned a very important point, which is that, you know, at some point when symptoms, I mean, psychiatric symptoms such as anxiety, depression, psychosis, and others are getting too severe, unfortunately, there is often no way around to take medications. We always would like to avoid medications. Trust me, I think, you know, I speak for most of the psychiatrists who are dealing with patients. You know, if possible, we're happy to just not have to use medications. However, there is good news in a certain way that, you know, medications have become more efficient over the past decades, and I also have, you know, become more safe and more and well better tolerated in many ways. But still, the underlying problem is that once we are at this point that we feel medication needs to be taken or needs to be given, we never know who is going to respond to that medication in a way that, you know, makes it really clinically relevant, where, you know, patients really feel like they're doing much, much better now and they can, for example, go back to their previous level of functioning. And also, we never know who is going to develop side effects and to which severity potentially side effects will occur, which will have to result in discontinuation of medication. Now, that scenario has been particularly pronounced in psychiatry with our psychiatric medications. There are disciplines in medicine where, yes, you also see variation in drug treatment, but you see it to a much lesser extent. And also because psychiatric medication sometimes needs weeks to be fully, for them to be fully evaluated to which extent they do work, we also see a lot of time going by until we can really find sometime the right medication for the right patients at the right time. And that's, yes, please.
Right. And so I think it's important that when people come in to see a psychiatrist, usually they have suffered with some symptoms, whether it be anxiety, depression, even low-dose paranoia, for quite some time. Oftentimes people go to their primary care doctor first. A lot of people, there's still in society some self-stigma with having symptoms. So it's important to realize that usually by the time someone calls Dr. Mueller, or call someone like myself, I'm an adult and child psychiatrist, they've suffered for quite some time. They've probably had some therapy. They've already tried a round of good psychotherapy. Oftentimes with what we know about the benefits of meditation, people try meditation. They are very familiar with nutrition. A lot of people are aware of the importance of probiotics, microbiome. So what we're talking about is when someone gets to the level of moderate to severe symptoms, when they come to a psychiatrist's office, we take a holistic approach that includes the biological, psychological, and social approach. And then we're so fortunate to have researchers like Dr. Mueller, who has spent an extensive amount of his education and research helping us to fine-tune the right med and the right match for the right symptoms with the least amount of side effects.
Correct. Yeah, thank you. That is a very nice summary. So therefore, I was saying we have this variation, this variability between individuals, you know, so let's say, you know, you have two individuals who are coming to your clinic, for example, and you diagnose them with exactly the same condition, no matter what it is, you know, general anxiety disorders, major depression, whatever you call it. And then you give them exactly the same dose or exactly the same medication, you know, and then this is now where you can see a great success in one patient and no response or side effects in the other patient, right? That is exactly the variation which makes it very complicated, right? And it's true that often enough, you know, we would get referred patients, particularly in the first years of our, you know, of our services here, where, you know, the physicians would say, look, I have tried so much, I don't know really what to do next. And perhaps, you know, you can help us to find out what works best if you might want to look at the, you know, at the genetics of the drug metabolizing enzymes, which we have been developing here. And however, over the past few years, we also get more and more, you know, patients at an earlier stage where, you know, doctors, for example, have made good experiences with our services, or where, you know, maybe doctors heard about our our research, and they felt convinced that it's a good idea. They might have also been reminded, or they might have also been, you know, indicated by their patient that it might be safer to also, you know, before they start any medication, to maybe look at the drug metabolizing enzymes. And this is how things have evolved. And so far here in Toronto, we have now assessed more than 7,000 patients over the last 6 years or so. That's a lot of patients. And you know, we have been getting, when we did surveys, and I was personally in charge of doing these surveys also to the physicians, they all indicated that, you know, they found it very useful, and most importantly, no one got harmed by our, you know, suggestions, by our kind of assessment, you know, like certainly do not want to, you know, cause any troubles or any harm by, you know, suggesting things or recommendations which then at the end might, you know, not benefit the patient, but might even harm or so, you know. So, but coming back a little bit earlier, the variation is the problem. So now the variation, where is it coming from? This is just, you know, just a basically fundamental question. Why do people respond differently? And there are very, you know, various reasons why that is the case. One of them is genetics, as you said, but the other ones, we should also, other variables which might also be important should be kept in mind. There is certainly a factor of age, there is a factor of gender, ethnic background and cultural background might also play a role. Definitely also importantly for psychiatrists is, you know, even though you call a certain syndrome maybe depression, for example, or maybe schizophrenia, but however, the symptoms that people can be affected with can be very different, even though you call it the same name. So the symptom profile, as I say, is also very important. And then there is also drug-drug interactions, which means if you give another drug to someone who is already taking a drug or who might get another drug later on, these drugs may interact because they compete for metabolic pathways, and that can also dramatically change the picture. I always cite a case report from Sheldon Prescorn in Kansas City, who has once been involved in a case where a patient was given 20 depressants at the same time, amitriptyline and fluoxetine. And unfortunately, this patient died eventually because fluoxetine would impede the elimination of amitriptyline through the metabolic pathways. And then basically this patient was was killed, if you wish, by an overdose of amitriptyline, which gradually accumulated in his system. So
for everyone listening, Dr. Mueller's talking about an antidepressant that affects different neurotransmitters. So amitriptyline focuses on hitting the norepinephrine system, and he was talking about Prozac, fluoxetine, and the serotonin system. And that when any time you see a doctor or primary care doctor, someone has to look at all the different medications you're on and look for drug-drug interactions. And so this is why I feel strongly that the decision to put someone on a psychiatric medicine needs to be done with care, concern, and with proper evaluation and communication with all doctors. Because sometimes patients will be almost like doctor shopping, like they won't even remember to tell you that they're on one medicine. So a very thorough history is incredibly important to not have the fatality that Dr. Mueller just discussed.
Right. I think the important point is that whenever you give a drug, you have to be very careful in what other drug this particular patient might be already taking. You have to check for drug-drug interactions very carefully, and also warn the patient that from now on, every time he or she might take a new medication, to carefully, discuss and mention that to the new, to the next prescribing physician, in order for them to check for potential drug-drug interactions. I think this is extremely important because we still see way too many, problems, emergency room visits due to preventable drug-drug interactions. So that's a general kind of statement here. However, as you can imagine, going back to the variation, why do people respond differently to the certain drugs? Again, one of the factors is that these, you know, patients might be already on another drug, which interferes, and that causes a variation as one factor. Now, I have specialized in another variable, in another domain here, and that is the biomarker genetic component of drug metabolism and action of drug. So that is called pharmacogenetics in particular, and this is what you, Denise, already mentioned earlier on. So the pharmacogenetics has the concept to study the genes which are involved or associated with, let's say, drug metabolism, therapeutic response, and side effects. Okay, and so there are studies which have clearly shown that certain genes, you know, will be affecting the dose of the drug that you need. There are studies out there that show that certain genetic variants will also determine if you respond to a certain medication. And last not least, there are also studies which clearly indicate that certain genetic variants put you at a high risk for certain side effects. And so over the years, that area of research has evolved. And I think we can say the first step at this moment, we do believe that if you know which genetic variation you do possess, which determines the activity of certain drug metabolizing enzymes, then you should also be better off with choosing and selecting the dose of an antidepressant medication and some antipsychotic medications as well.
Can you give everyone listening kind of an overview of where most medications are metabolized in the liver versus the kidney and the cytochrome P450 system, as though someone was in your clinic, so they can have a basic level and foundation so we can kind of flesh out the context of what you're discussing?
Very good, yes. So basically, most medications, or basically all medications that are taken for psychiatric conditions, are medications which have to enter the blood-brain barrier and, you know, penetrate into the brain tissue, because this is where most of the psychiatric symptoms will come from, right? Although, you know, there might be a few tiny exceptions, but we believe that, you know, psychiatric disorders are mostly related to brain functioning, right? So to the central nervous system. Okay, and the central nervous system, the brain is composed, this is now a bit pharmacology here, if you wish, and biochemistry, the brain is mostly composed of fat, right? Fatty tissues and so on. So fat molecules, I mean. And in order for a drug to penetrate the brain, you know, a drug has to also have, as we say, lipophilic component. It means the drug has to have the ability to penetrate fat tissue. Otherwise, it's not going to enter the brain tissue, right? So, and therefore, every drug is made in a certain way such that, you know, it can nicely cross the blood-brain barrier and penetrate the brain tissue where it is doing its effects. However, in order to be eliminated from the body, a molecule needs to be made soluble in water. That's called hydrophilic. And therefore, we have in our liver and elsewhere enzymes which are, you know, continuously identifying these molecules which are, you know, flowing through our blood system, and will work against them to eliminate them, and will make them hydrophilic. Okay, they will add what we call, you know, a certain hydroxy group, for example, and after that, the drug can be eliminated either through the urine, through the kidneys, or through the bile, and then ultimately through the stool, right? This is the most common metabolic pathways for most of the drugs. Probably 95% of the drugs that are taken for psychiatric conditions are, metabolized in this way. A few exceptions, just to keep in mind, a few exceptions are drugs which are exclusively eliminated by the kidney, but these are again a minority. They can become important, for example, in patients who have liver diseases or liver problems, because now you could have a way of circumvent the liver pathways, right? Okay.
And this is why we need to have a good routine physical. We need to do blood work. We need to usually check the thyroid, the liver enzymes, and the kidney function and overall prior to this. And now with Dr. Mueller's extensive research and his pioneering work in specific biomarkers, we're now, as doctors, able to get more specific as to the metabolism of the meds and what's going to genetically match up with you. So it's very important that you get a good screening from your primary care doctor and that your psychiatrist does the lab work and such.
Ooh, correct, yes. So that is certainly true. Many medical conditions can mimic themselves as psychiatric conditions, which means depression or any other psychiatric condition is diagnosed for the first time, it is always extremely important to rule out any potential medical conditions. And you mentioned thyroid hormones, for example. That is extremely important, for example, because thyroid dysfunction can in fact mimic a severe depression, for example. And on top of that, you want to not just rule out conditions by doing so, but you also want to make sure, as you said, that your body is working, adequately or properly in order to also make decisions about the medication that you would prescribe. And again, I mentioned that case if someone has a liver condition, maybe liver cirrhosis, in an early stage or fatty liver conditions and other things, you might not want to give a medication which is metabolized by the liver. You expect the liver is already struggling and in distress, and that makes no sense to then give medications where the liver is further being compromised. So, and there are a few exceptions, again, a few medications which are exclusively eliminated by the kidney, but these are just exceptions, and unfortunately most drugs sometimes who work very well are not sometimes those or are often not those that you would like to take for the who are metabolized by the kidney, for example. Yeah, but it is important to just keep that notion in mind, because as I will show or as I will discuss, there are also let's say situations where someone is not suffering from a standard classical liver condition, but is genetically put up that way that this person might not be able to metabolize medications as well, because this person was born with non-functional, as we say, alleles for a certain drug metabolizing enzyme. And although I don't want to become too technical here, I believe, however, there's one name of an enzyme that people should know at this point of time, those who are taking psychiatric medications, and that name is called cytochrome P452D, like Daniel, 6. So, and the abbreviation is CYP2D6. So CYP2D6 is extremely important for psychiatric medications, because many medications are metabolized by CYP2D6, and there is a huge genetic variation for CYP2D6. Some people don't have a functioning enzyme at all. We call them poor metabolizers at this point. And then some people have copies of the gene, which makes them even more faster than the general population, and we call them ultra rapid metabolizers. And for that enzyme, there is a huge bulk of data out there which clearly shows that if you take a drug which is metabolized by CYP2D6, that this will affect how you do and how you respond to that drug. And the nice thing is that with genetic testing, you can nicely estimate the activity of that enzyme, because you can clearly show, for example, if it's absent by, you know, by doing a simple genetic test, you can see this gene does not have a functional copy in your genome, and that's a poor metabolizer. And you can also nicely see if the gene is multiplicated and there's multiple copies across your genome, which means you are a rapid metabolizer. So, and that is a first step where we stepped in, and that at some point we should be just, you know, offering that assessment as a part of a research study in order to see how patients will do and how the outcome is when we are, you know, alerting and advising patients and physicians what to do in case their CYP2D6 enzyme is not in the normal range.
Dr. Mueller, how far away are we as a society from having that be standard of care in our clinics? How far along? Thank you so much for your research and being the pioneer in helping guide patients and doctors. So how far off do you think we are from that being something that's integrated into routine psychiatric care?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. I believe that it's actually happening right now in many clinics elsewhere in the world. And to be fair, I think the pioneer to really start doing that kind of screening on a regular routine basis has actually been Dr. David Mrazek's and his team. David Mrazek, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but he worked at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and they have routinely started using genetic testing about 10, 12 years ago in all their patients, and including children and adolescents. That was at a time, I must say, when people were rather unconvinced in general that this would, be feasible and show clinical utility. And yes, since then we've come a long way. We have definitely improved our understanding of the gene. We have definitely accumulated more data. And so on. However, it is now happening in more and more clinics. The hurdles are definitely that it is still very new to many of us, to physicians likewise, and to patients, that notion that you get a genetic testing. And it's also, of course, a question who's going to pay for it, right? So these are hurdles.
That's what I was just going to ask, like how to write that order and then how to implement that.
Right. So now there are always, certain factors which will determine if something gets implemented or not. And it is, I tried to understand also at some point, these concepts here that I'm talking about, drugs being metabolized by CYP2D6, for example, they're not new concepts. I haven't discovered that myself. It's been out there for some time.
Yes. In fact, can I make this a point?
Sure.
So back when I was at Emory University doing my adult psychiatry, for everyone listening, most doctors took this into consideration long standing. We've always known that medications are metabolized and the way that Dr. Mueller has spoken about, but now he's doing the more fine-tuning clinical tests and the genetic tests. But a very classic thing that we learned in medical school and in residency and fellowship is, let's say if it's an adult and maybe they tell you, oh my goodness, I cannot handle a glass of wine. My face starts to have red flushing. So there was more clinical questions we could ask and also asking people how they've responded to different medications in the past that are metabolized by the CYP2D6. So as clinicians, we have ways of ascertaining, but they're not as precise. So that's been included longstanding in the time I've been practicing medicine. But now with Dr. Mueller and the Mayo Clinic and all the other pioneers and doctors in the pharmacogenetic world, we're getting more savvy and more efficient so we can help our patients with the least amount of side effects and the most amount of clinical benefit.
Correct. Yes, right. That's very well said. So basically, the concepts that drugs are metabolized by these enzymes aren't new. The point is, however, it is still new for many that who are dealing with these drugs, and it is particularly new to know that you can get some testing done, which is rather which is rather accurate to that point, that you can really deduct therapeutic implications about that. But again, why is this not implemented on a wider scale? Again, as while it is happening in more and more clinics across the world, and there are several clinics in the US also now who are implementing that testing in their clinics across the US, and I've been in regular phone conferences with teams outside there who are implementing it really as a routine, preemptive, as we say, testing, and that information will also be available then on the medical records of a patient, so that every physician from then on will be aware of the genetic profile and also of the implications of it. Now, again, there is some costs related to it. Obviously, genetic testing now has become really relatively inexpensive, compared to many other medical interventions. And the nice thing about a genetic test is, you just have to pay for it once, because once you've paid for it, and once you know your genetic profile, it's not going to change throughout your life, right? So you can expect that, with one test, you can get a long, long way until maybe in the future, in another 10 years, maybe there is better techniques to further assess, the genome and so, your genome, and maybe get, more subtle, more additional subtle information. However, as it stands, a genetic test is one thing for a lifetime. And we're talking about, lab costs. We're talking about a few hundred dollars probably to get a very good assessment of your genome conducted.
Now, I can imagine people listening to this might now go to their primary care doctors or their psychiatrist and say, I really want this testing. So is it something that they're all throughout the United States that people are would know to write on a lab slip, or how would they talk to their doctors about that?
Right. That's another good question. How do you get to it? Now, definitely, it depends on where you are. It depends on which doctor you're seeing in a certain way, and how well the doctor is maybe connected in a network of, practitioners and clinicians and so on, where this might become an option. However, I should mention there are also commercially available tests now, which are basically, of course, open for everyone, as long as someone is willing to pay for them. Individually, that's always an option. Now, sometimes it happens that people have insurance companies who are already also covering for these costs, right? Because insurance companies have also made a calculation at some point and found out, at least some of them, that, if they pay for the genetic testing, it will save them money later on.
Right.
So,
Do you have the link to that specific commercially available site, or can you give us an idea of how someone could find that?
Well, sure. I mean, there are several companies out there, and I certainly, certainly do not wish to.
You don't want to endorse any specific place. This isn't some sales pitch for genetic test for specific genetic testing. Perhaps what we would say to someone is, please go to your doctor, listen to what your doctor has to say, and say, "Oh, I've heard that there's different ways that we all metabolize medications. Doctor, right. Would you do that in your lab, or how can I go about doing this?" And I imagine people could probably Google search, specifically what we just spoke about, right? Genetic testing for CYP2D6, and they can put that in there and then work with their doctors to get that answer.
Absolutely. That's very easy to find online, I'm sure.
Perfect.
And, depending on where in the US you live and where in the US, you are attached to, maybe, if you are close to a university hospital, a university clinic, there might be a chance they're doing a study, or they offer this as part of their routine or research. In other areas, it might just be that you have other ways of finding yourself a lab or something, which is offering the testing. That's easily found.
Now, so I have a question. With all this happening, do you see any drawbacks in now, once someone has their genetic information, is there any drawback into getting coverage or into insurance companies knowing how they metabolize medications? Has that come into play?
Well, certainly. I mean, my current recommendation would be that, you know, whenever a psychiatric medication is being recommended by a doctor at this point of time, be it for the first time or maybe for the second or third time, because, you know, maybe there's a history that certain medications haven't worked, I would always recommend to bring this into the conversation and say, listen, I've heard about, you know, these genetic tests which can help to find the right medication. Do you know if my insurance company or, you know, should I not talk to my insurance company? Could be another way of saying it, to see whether or not they're covering or they have it in their profile. And, you know, surprisingly often, maybe insurance companies are already doing it or are already aware of that. Or at least, you know, can be persuaded also, you know, on an individual contact to perhaps pay for a certain test like that, right? And if this is not the case, or if someone has not insurance company at this point of time, I would advise to do some research whether or not there is research clinics out there who might be doing it as part of their research at this point of time. Yes. In this case, for example, we do offer this as you know, if you wish, we offer this as a part of our research studies right now for free here in Ontario and to some extent across Canada. And all we need to have is access to a phone and a mailbox, because we can send the envelope for the genetic testing, and people just have to swap their cheek, you know, or they have to, you know, get saliva in a saliva tube. Send it back to us. We do genetic testing, and we do all the counseling, all the reporting through mail, right?
That's fantastic. So it's really important that people can know where you're at and what your clinic's doing.
Right. So and there is a good likelihood that, again, there are other centers across the U.S. which do the same thing.
Yes.
Now, we have said that in our study, we want to have a physician included, okay, which means the physician is basically the one who's then getting the report, okay? Because we just feel like, you know, any report which talks about medications and explains a test, you know, should ideally be going through the referring and prescribing physician, okay? That's just different. If you just do a commercial test on your own, you get the results yourself, right, at your place. But then you need to go to, you know, then
it needs to be interpreted. It needs to be taken into context, because a lot of times you can't. Anything, when you're talking about someone's emotional well-being, you're looking at their labs, you're also looking at their cultural influence, their own belief system about the soul. You can't just look at one number and metabolism and be your own doctor. And I think with the internet age, a lot of people will get their numbers or their answers, and then they'll start Googling everything. And it's really important for people to remember that if you are suffering with anxiety, depression, paranoia, and that you get the right therapist, the right doctor, and the right treatment team, and that Dr. Mueller's body of work, which we're so grateful for, is helping us to fine-tune so that your body as a machine is metabolizing things and able to tolerate the medicine in the best way possible.
Correct, yes. And again, this should not sound too complicated. I'm just saying, you know, there are various options out there to get yourself tested. I always recommend to have a physician included who knows medications and who's, you know, basically able to also advise you based on your genetic profile. However, that, you know, if you want to get the best treatment and you want to, you know, maximize the odds of doing well on a medication, you want to minimize the risk of developing side effects, that's certainly the way to go at this moment of time. In particular for antidepressant and antipsychotic medications. I'm saying this because there are various classes of medications out there against anxiety, against addictions, against, you know, mood instability. But at this point of time, antidepressant and antipsychotics are the most well-studied, and I think we can make fair recommendations.
Okay, and then from a time standpoint, you have so much knowledge, and I think as psychiatrists, if we have people who are requiring more medications that have a higher level profile of side effects, if someone's having perhaps a very kind of intense bipolar episode that includes paranoia, or someone that is having schizophrenic symptoms. I know your current research has been particularly successful in identifying gene variants associated with antipsychotic-induced weight gain. And so can you give us sort of an overview? If we were in your office and let's say a family member was suffering with these symptoms, and give us some insights as to how your current research has helped guide the treatment to minimize some of the side effects that are associated with antipsychotics?
Yes, right. So first of all, there are rare but sometimes severe side effects with antipsychotics, but there are also common and maybe initially or potentially less severe side effects with antipsychotics. So we have been particularly focusing on the common ones, which can be severe as well, but for example, we talk about antipsychotic-induced weight gain. You know, weight gain is common with antipsychotic medication, unfortunately. 30% of patients gain weight to some extent. Some just gain a little, and that's why I say, okay, then this is maybe less severe then. However, some patients gain a lot of weight, and then it becomes a severe side effect, right? And we don't know exactly why this is, why people do gain weight, but we certainly believe that it is not a necessary side effect. It's not like it's a price to pay for the good effects of this drug. We believe that you can counteract weight gain as much as you can and still keep the good effects of the drugs. Which is not easy, of course, and here a way of preventing, maybe to guide people, to guide physicians properly through that difficult dilemma whether or not to prescribe an antipsychotic which might have a high risk for weight gain. We have been working extensively on the genetics of antipsychotic-induced weight gain, and we have looked at many pathways and genes which are involved in appetite and satiety regulation, and also genes which are modulated by antipsychotics, certain receptors, for example, but were at the same time also implicated in appetite and weight regulation. And I think we've come up with a very nice understanding of the genetics of antipsychotic-induced weight gain to that extent that we will hopefully be able to assemble a certain genetic risk profile model, which we can apply, and then we know preemptively whether or not a patient has a high risk to gain weight or not. And in both cases, this is valuable information because
it is fantastic information, because so many people are afraid to go on these types of medications. They just have fear, and they're like, I'd rather have low grade paranoia than end up having severe diabetes. And it's a really catch 22 because when you're already paranoid, you might not even trust the doctor you're seeing. And so having some specific guidelines and lots of patient education and family support and all the information is invaluable for someone reaching more of a remission state where someone's not suffering with their psychiatric symptoms.
Correct, right. This is exactly the point. Sometimes people say, why do you need a genetic test if you already know that these drugs are causing weight gain? I'm telling them, sometimes people just don't take the medications because they're afraid of weight gain and they might not gain weight. So these people would be the first to benefit. But on top of that, if I know that someone is at high risk, I can start managing weight issues right from the get-go. I can certainly say, look, if you take this medication, we'll have to monitor you very carefully. You should start your diet and exercise program right away. You should be monitored. You should get a dietitian. You should get maybe a therapist, these kind of things. And not just to wait and after a while, maybe after 6 months, say, oh, now you gain a lot of weight. Now we got to do something, right? That doesn't make sense. This is not preventive medicine. This is just basically medicine at its worst, which is, starting to take care of problems once they have already occurred.
Right. We're talking about being proactive, not reactive. And I think one of the common themes that I talk about is remembering that we're all neurodiverse. We all process and perceive information in our own unique way. And the discussion that we're having today is that we also metabolize medication genetically in our own unique way based on our baseline function of our liver, our kidney, and other drug-drug interactions if we're on medicines have other issues.
Mm-hmm. Right, correct. And there are good reasons to consider genetic testing also because, many other non-psychiatric medications are also, often metabolized by similar drug metabolizing enzymes. You know, we don't have like an infinite numbers of drug metabolizing enzymes. You know, we have maybe 30 or so, which are important in all medications. And you know, as research progresses, we are able to give a very good genetic profile of all the 30, let's say, you know, drug metabolizing enzymes. And then if, you know, if you take a pain medication the next months, or maybe a statin, you know, to lower your cholesterol, you will also want to know which genetic, you know, which genetic profile you have, because it might be that you don't also tolerate one of the other drugs, right?
Right. Do you see that this is actually going to be widespread in our lifetime? That this will be cost effective? That this will be like standard? Like everyone gets this kind of testing so that we can better guide the treatment of medicine for our patients?
I believe so. Yes, I believe so. And again, genetics is, if you will, still the first step, right? As I mentioned, there are other factors which also contribute to how you respond to drugs. It includes age, gender, maybe lifestyle factors, you know, body mass index, nutrition. You know, you mentioned probiotics, nutrition. These are all important factors. We should not forget about them. But the ideal algorithm will at some point, you know, include, you know, stable factors such as genetics, you know, which you have, you know, for your lifetime determined, and then maybe more dynamic factors, you know.
Yes, and you know what we've talked about on other shows is, you know, there's also what we know as the placebo effect, and the someone's belief system individually and their ability to get well and be well and have a wellness mindset going into treatment. I think if we were to have sort of almost like a pre-appointment before appointments with doctors that get people in the most relaxed state of thinking about their health, engaging them in their treatment, feeling empowered, because you know, just because you have a certain genetic background or a mood issue. And back, by the way, I know the word disorder is used by us in psychiatry, but I really talk with my patients about their neuro style, because if people get so tagged to an illness type of thinking, I want to validate that people are feeling ill and that we need a uniform way of discussing things in science and material science. However, the power of the mind and your energy of healing, that's another kind of variable that we've seen with placebo response and the kind of almost like the ability for one to have hope to be well is another part of a big part of the dynamic factor of getting well. And also in trusting the doctor that you're seeing or the therapist you're seeing or the healer that you're seeing.
Correct. Yes, that's true. And now definitely that is important in most conditions in psychiatry, that I would agree, you know, the environment and the you know, power feeling and your attitudes will do a lot of will do a lot of, you know, or will be a major component, as you said, you know. I was saying, though, you know, there are stable maybe factors which don't change throughout your life, like genetics, but there are dynamic factors which you can modulate and which may have tremendous impact as well. And for example, I would just, you know, I was just involved in a small but I found very important study, which showed that, you know, if people who are depressed later in life, but who had the unfortunate, you know, an unfortunate history of childhood abuse in their childhood or in their adolescence, you know, that this will also determine how well they respond to an antidepressants, right? So, and that can be explained maybe through certain, you know, neurobiological, you know, complexities that have occurred during, you know, or as a result of the abuse, you know, during lifetime, and these are more dynamic factors, right? But they need to be taken into account, and you know, a good preemptive testing one day will also ask for maybe trauma in the past.
Yes, and I think it's important. It's really interesting. I was at a lecture last year, and the word psychiatrist in Greek means doctor of the soul. So when I think of someone that's had any sort of trauma or any sort of very big hardship, there's other underlying factors that from a kind of a linear perspective, there's non-linear influences. And that's why I really embrace my Western medicine training, but I also embrace Eastern philosophy. And I co-creates my knowledge in both areas, and I respect each individual's belief system. Because if someone's had a trauma, a childhood trauma, or some sort of physical or sexual abuse in any stage in their life, their ability to trust another human being is impaired. And so it's like you have to start with sort of the healing of that before someone can. I'm not saying you wouldn't do, it's not multifactorial, you would work with your own doctor, but it's a very important part of the treatment plan to take into consideration. When someone feels cared for and loved, and, you know, people do have deep compassion when they're working with their doctor, their therapist, or their healer. That compassionate, caring part of the treatment is a big part of the healing and adjunct to the biological, psychological, and social piece of well-being.
Yes, that's very important. And by the way, you mentioned beliefs, and I want to maybe add a certain, observation here that I've made also over the years, which is, the beliefs of genetic testing are in a certain way often a little bit, deterministic. And I caution people to not believe that genetic testing, no matter what genetic testing they do, with the exception of maybe those, clearly highly genetically correlated conditions, where one gene determines an illness or an outcome, for example, Huntington's disease. But with all the other, complex phenotypes or traits, which includes, most psychiatric conditions, which includes response to drugs, a genetic test will only capture a certain portion of the variance. It will never be, or hard to believe that it's going to be ever deterministic, that you will know exactly with that genetic profile, there is no way that you will not respond or that you will absolutely respond to that medication. Genetic testing at this point of time needs to be considered as a probabilistic, as a probabilistic variable, where you will increase your likelihood to do well on a medication and you will decrease your likelihood of not doing well. But you can never, at this point of time, and I caution that because, I don't want to oversell and sound overpromising. At this point of time, we don't have that high, 99.9% accuracy or, as we say, sensitivity and specificity, right? Well, so keep that in mind, because many people, when they hear genetic testing, believe it's a deterministic
Mueller, thank you so much for saying that. This is such an amazing way to kind of finish, because we're talking about, it's like taking a snapshot when you're on vacation. You capture a portion of it, but you don't capture the whole experience in the context. And there's also epigenetics and the food that we eat and the exercise that we do and the faith that we have can greatly influence our ability to go from crisis into stabilization and into thriving, whether it's in a psychiatric way or as in any medical way. So it's really incredible, because your body of work and all that you've accomplished to further research, and for you to say that is excellent. And I really appreciate that people listen, because sometimes people might think, oh, Dr. Mueller is doing this research, so he puts all the emphasis on the genetic testing. Or for me, one of my patients heard that I was going to be, kind of formally integrating a meditation part of the practice. They were worried that I was going to give up prescribing meds, because people tend to. They're like, no, Dr. McDermott, you're not going to only tell me to go meditate, And so the way the human brain is set up is we often tag outcomes. So if we get a genetic test, we might think very fatalistically, I have this disorder, my life is doomed. Or I metabolize a medicine this way, then I can only do this. And so when you work with your doctor or psychologist, please make sure they take an approach like Dr. Mueller does, where he says, yes, I value my research. We've got the science, we're taking the scientific method, but there's multifactorial, multidimensional ways to heal. So I really appreciate Dr. Mueller. I know that you believe it and say it, but some people, do you agree? They might look at, do you agree with what I just said? People sort of get panicked.
Right. Now, let me ask you, let me add one more sentence, because, I wouldn't like to, to have the notion someone believes in something and someone doesn't, there is experts group out there, such as, the Clinical Pharmacogenomics Implementation Consortium, or abbreviated CPIC, and I'm part of this. And, you know, we're experts around the world. We're evaluating the data very, very carefully, very, very thoroughly. And despite being, you know, relatively conservative, if you wish, we can only conclude that it makes sense, you know, at this point of time, if you have the genetic information available, to use it for, you know, a lot of antidepressants and, you know, more and even for some antipsychotics, you know. However, so it's not that, you know, there's believers and non-believers. There is data. There's
scientific data. No, it's very important that we know that we look at the scientific method and that we're open to all ways of healing, but that the scientific method is valued and that we keep an open mind throughout our lives as doctors and as people who are coming to see their doctors, that you advocate for yourself and your health and your well-being and make sure you get the data and the experience of a great clinician.
Right. And these articles have been published for these tricyclics antidepressants, you know, maybe, you know, we can say the older antidepressants. We have clearly shown that the data is sufficient, convincing to give out strong recommendations. We've done this for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the SSRI antidepressants, again, showing that, you know, there is recommendations based on scientific evidence. And the next things are going to be antipsychotics, where we will do the same thing, and so on. And the CPIC is a wonderful group of people who is, you know, meeting regularly, working very hard in order to, you know, provide guidance, you know, to anyone who is interested in applying or, you know, using genetic information. And this is, I think, important to keep in mind. Everything we're doing here is mostly, you know, is exclusively, I should say, science-driven.
Yes.
And based on data.
Right? Yes. This is outstanding. And so can you let everyone know how they can find you and read more about your cutting-edge research that you're doing?
Sure. Thank you. So we came up with this website, pharmacogenetics.ca. We thought it's the easiest, easy to remember word. Pharmacogenetics.ca is our website, where we post regularly updates. Otherwise, we have our institution, CAMH, at here in Toronto, Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH.ca, where I work. And I'm on Twitter also. My Twitter account is at Mueller underscore DJ. Mueller is spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R and then underscore DJ. And that's ways of connecting, for example.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and all the work that you do. I have an introduction for you, but your CV is so clinically rich with all the research you've done, and there's such a value in the science that you're doing and all of your cohorts are doing. So thank you again, Dr. Mueller, for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me, Denise. It was a wonderful experience.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us today on the Dr. Denise Show. If you are interested in more mental health tips, tools, and discussions, I'm also on the web at drdenisemd.com, drdenisemd.com. I'm also on Twitter at drdenisemd and on Facebook. Okay, thank you again, everyone. Have a nice week. Bye-bye.